Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the
How do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression?
It's breathtaking, you know, for folks that are listening to this. I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps, and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. See you there.
Following, you'll hear of that and more, following the latest United Nations News in Brief.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. The United Nations and the organization's partners in the Central African Republic have issued a strong message to armed groups amid an uptick in pre-election violence, insisting that the national poll will go ahead as planned. The statement by the G5 group, which includes the European Union, Russia, the United States and the World Bank, calls for the immediate and unconditional end to coordinated offensives and scaremongering which threaten the electoral process. Instability in the Central African Republic dates back decades. Violence has displaced hundreds of thousands in the country, which, despite immense natural mineral wealth, is one of the poorest in the world. To date, more than 1.8 million citizens have registered to vote, and voting cards have been distributed throughout the country ahead of Sunday's poll, according to the group, which also includes Mankeur Ndiaye, Special Representative of the UN Secretary General. Mr. Ndiaye took to Twitter at the weekend to reassure citizens that UN peacekeepers would do their utmost to ensure the security of the electoral process. He also called on people not to panic. In its statement, the G5 said that it condemned all efforts to force the country into a new political transition in violation of the constitution. It named former President François Bozizé and unnamed armed elements before calling on them to lay down their weapons immediately. The G5 statement also firmly condemned all collusion between political actors and armed groups looking to create disorder and panic among the population to prevent them from their sovereign right to vote. Global health agency Unitaid has welcomed a $40 million contribution from Norway towards its COVID-19 treatment and testing work for the benefit of low- and middle-income countries. Unitaid said that it would collaborate with partners to push forward the development of high-quality, affordable self-tests for coronavirus that are suitable for use in low-resource settings. The UN agency also intends to adapt existing COVID-19 treatments and help countries to prepare to roll out promising treatments. These include monoclonal antibodies, lab-made drugs that mirror the body's immune response. Efforts to assess priceless cultural heritage in and around Nagorno-Karabakh to help promote a lasting peace have stalled, UNESCO said on Monday. In an appeal to Azerbaijan's government to allow experts to access the enclave and border regions, the UN Cultural, Scientific and Educational Agency said that all countries had an obligation to protect cultural heritage. This is in line with the 1954 convention to which Armenia and Azerbaijan are parties. Ernesto Otone, UNESCO Assistant Director General for Culture, said that the authorities in Azerbaijan had been approached several times for permission to enter without success. He added that the opportunity offered by the ceasefire agreed between Azerbaijan and Armenia on the 9th of November should not be lost. Ahead of the truce, 6 weeks of escalating conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh left thousands reportedly killed and more than 100,000 displaced. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Hello and welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. Make sure you never miss an episode and ping me an email on naomi@taxjustice.net and tell me what you think about the show. Coming up later.
That's a brilliant, easily collected tax. Doesn't cause any pain to investors. I mean, there are damn few alternatives. Do you want us to really just fire all the state workers? Shutting down schools and laying off teachers. You know, how do you get Wall Street to pay its fair share here?
We take a look at the transformative power of financial transactions taxes. There's a chance that New York, home to two of the world's largest stock exchanges, could be about to set an important precedent. There's two bits of good news to share with you this month. In the United States, campaigners have been fighting to end secret company ownership for years and years. Enough politicians have now woken up to the fact that facilitating money laundering through financial secrecy is a national security threat. It means that now Congress has passed a defense bill which includes making corporations identify who owns and controls them. It also strengthens whistleblower protections. The bill has plenty of weaknesses, but it's an important step forward. And also, Portugal wants the European Union's Council of Member States to have a vote on public country-by-country reporting by multinationals. Portugal takes over the rotating presidency at the start of 2021. The European Union already has rules that make banks and the extractive sector do some reporting on their profits on a country-by-country basis, and the OECD publishes some data, but only for lots of companies all bundled up together. All eyes are now on Germany for this EU vote, which will need to switch its position from neutral to supporting, or for one of the other countries in opposition to switch. If the vote passes, it could be good news for the Global South in particular in being able to quantify how much tax big companies aren't paying in their countries, and for the public worldwide to know which companies and which countries are cheating the rest of us. Okay, let's talk to John Christensen now from the Tax Justice Network for his take on three major waves of change in 2020. The Black Lives Matter protests, Trump's departure from the White House, and the end of the Brexiteer's dream. Okay, John, 2020 is a year most of us are glad to see the back of. The COVID pandemic has dominated everything this year, and we're not really going to talk about that very much today, but it has at least reconnected people with the idea that the state should be there to protect them and act in their interests. And it's all reconnected people with the idea tax is central to everything, right at the heart of everything, and things like universal public health care and all that sort of thing. After all, every second, the equivalent of one nurse's annual salary is lost to a tax haven. It takes decades for discontent, the type that we've seen in recent years, to boil over, and for politicians to exploit and misdirect people's anger. And the anger that Trump, for example, manipulated and the Brexiteers have manipulated has been building up for such a long time, going all the way back to at least Thatcher and Reagan. As Gramsci said, the old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. We've had Bolsonaro, Orban, Trump, Johnson. How do you think historians are going to view these times that we're living through? As the age of monsters? The age of rule breakers? I mean, for decades, the powerful have been rigging economies in their favour, and this year there's been some quite strong pushes back against that. Let's take a look at three major curveballs this year in 2020.
Well, I think you're absolutely right to ask this question about whether this is the age of monsters. And let's not forget that when Antonio Gramsci wrote that famous line about the age of monsters, he was being held in prison by the Italian fascist Benito Mussolini, and that was during a very similar period of turmoil after the stock market collapses in New York and in Europe. And the old era was dying, quite clearly dying, and capitalism had to be rebooted. And I think that's pretty much where we're at the moment, because neoliberalism has so clearly been dying for a long time now, and to all intents and purposes is now dead. Now, 2020, of course, has been particularly uncomfortable because the COVID pandemic has exposed how monstrous the leaders of some of the countries really are, especially in terms of their indifference to public health. I mean, Donald Trump and Jair Bolsonaro really stick out in this respect. And I think Trump especially sticks out because of his really weak handling of the murder of George Floyd and the way in which he handled the subsequent uprising of communities who were protesting against the persistent racism in the police forces in the US.
Right, and in the United States, there must be now an accountability process, a criminal justice process. And Biden, President-elect Biden, may be presenting a more diverse team on the surface, but he's going to need a diversity of professional experience. I mean, for example, reforming the criminal justice system, he's going to need a lot of criminal defense lawyers, not prosecutors, which is the tendency.
And the rallying of the Black Lives Matters movement around George Floyd's murder has brought people onto the streets right the way across the world. And it's opened up discussions around the legacies, including the legacies of slavery in so many countries. History is inevitably politicized in the interests of the powerful elites. And you can see why they'd want to close down any discussion around the legacy of slavery in many countries. But what Black Lives Matter has achieved is the opening up of a debate that has largely excluded the voices of the victims of slavery, colonialism, and the victims of imperialism. From an economist's perspective, this debate seems particularly important because students of economics, they seldom ever look at how power relations shape economic relations. But when you look at the rapid industrialization of the big imperialist powers in the 19th century and the 20th century, it's absolutely clear that much of the capital accumulated, all the wealth that was accumulated during that period, originated from the slave economies and from the weapons industries that protected those economies. The plundering of India and the plundering of most African countries, not to mention the entire continent of South America, deprived those regions of the capital resources they needed to invest in their own long-term development processes. And let's not forget also that the plundering didn't come to an end when the Wars of Independence forced the colonialists to retreat. Anyone who has watched the Spidersweb film, its subtitle is Britain's Second Empire, will know that the global rise of tax havens and the rigging of the rules for taxing multinational companies to favour the interests of European and North American countries, these have been crucial parts of the globalisation project pushed by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. And historians have frankly only just started to explore the history of tax havens and how they have reinforced imperial power relations and created new forms of systemic injustice.
Right, and so much work to be done there. And so we've seen this year Trump defeated. It wasn't the blue wave that the Democrats had hoped for, but it's still historic in the sense that the nationalist, anti-democratic agenda for the radical right will take a hit, but not for long. And Democrats have got to be about much more than just opposing Trump, right? I mean, are the Democrats going to understand that these times call for radical measures on the climate emergency and fair distribution of wealth? Are they understanding that the United States must do what it failed to do under many administrations and join in with global tax rules that really clamp down on unaccountable, untaxed wealth and profits and start to get criminogenic corporates and finance companies under some kind of control?
Well, of course, that's something we'd all wish to happen, but it's important to bear in mind that despite Biden winning the popular vote by an astonishing 9 million or so votes, Donald Trump gained a record number of votes for any Republican contender for the presidency ever. So President-elect Biden needs to take really urgent action to address the underlying systemic causes of the deep division in the United States. And that will mean rewriting the rules that shape the way in which the pie, the economic pie, is divided between society. From a tax justice perspective, Biden needs to reverse the trend of the past 40 years towards cutting taxes on wealth and corporate profits. To begin with, he should simply scrap the 21% corporate income tax rate set by Trump in 2018, and he needs to reinstate the previous rate of 35%. I mean, he's been talking about 28 or so, but that's not ambitious enough. It needs to be back to 35%. And of course, very few large companies actually paid anything like that rate because of all the tax giveaways that have been accumulated over the last few decades. And these giveaways achieve little or nothing, so cut them out as well. But I don't think that Biden should stop there. Wall Street still earns fortunes from churning stocks and bonds and derivatives. So it's long overdue that the US applies a financial transaction tax, both as a mechanism for slowing down the churning process, but also for redistributing the revenue away from the speculators and into the public purse. And there are other measures that Biden could take at the domestic level to reduce extreme wealth inequality, introducing a wealth tax, for example, and other possibilities to introduce a carbon dividend to tax the big users of fossil fuels and redistribute the wealth to lower income households. And all of that could be done relatively easily. But of course, to do all of that effectively, he'll need to reinvest in the Internal Revenue Service, which has been badly depleted by the cuts imposed on it, not just by Trump, but also by his predecessor, Barack Obama. And we in the tax justice community should be watching carefully to see what action Biden takes to restore the capacity of the Internal Revenue Service. But when it comes to internationalism, Donald Trump took a wrecking ball to the existing order. And Biden is a self-proclaimed internationalist, and he'll need to take very strong measures to reverse that nationalist agenda. And for starters, he should sign the US up to the Common Reporting Standard for Automatic Information Exchange between tax authorities. The US has so far failed to sign up to that. And he can also promote the idea of country-by-country reporting by all US companies in all countries where they operate. That's just catching up with the rest of the world. Under Trump, the US has not played a positive role in shaping the OECD's base erosion profit-shifting discussions. And those discussions have stalled as a result of a lack of leadership. Now, the only way forward, which will lead to a durable and equitable framework for international taxation, lies with shifting away from the old arm's-length method and adopting unitary taxation. And from my point of view, that might be the best test of Biden. Will he or will he not make the necessary break away from the old order to a new order based upon unitary taxation? And will he then also lead the way in establishing a minimum tax rate, and maybe aligned with the 35% tax rate that previously applied in the US, to block the race to the bottom political impulses of the people on the radical right? So there you have it, a number of tests that we can apply to a Biden government to see whether he is the progressive and the internationalist that we'd like him to be.
Right, well, we'll see, won't we? And if we cross the pond, on the one hand, so you've had the US electorate choosing a more internationalist president who sees the collective benefit of rules. And on the other hand, the UK is only 1 year into the absolute opposite ideology, trampling all over the rules in the name of so-called sovereignty, which we could call fake sovereignty. Brexit is just another attempt, exactly like Trump's brand of nationalism, to undermine rules-based global trading agreements, push a race to the bottom for the benefit of elites, not ordinary people. And at the Tax Justice Network, we've been talking about the importance of a level playing field for years. And the European Union does seem to see the danger in what the UK is trying to do and is pushing back against it. I can't help thinking that only the British, and well, it's really the English, only the English could leave a club, reserve the right to shit all over it, and then still demand the same rights that the club offers. And the European Union would be failing in its duty to its own citizens if it was going to allow a big trading partner right on its doorstep to drive down wages, working conditions, environmental standards, financial regulatory standards, and yet still give them access to the single market. I mean, it's not that the European Union is as pure as a driven snow here. It does protect its tax haven nation state, but it doesn't want an extreme rule-breaking agenda that the Brexiteers want. So now we've got Britain very isolated. Trump has gone. Its rule-breaking partner in crime is no longer there. Doesn't have many friends left, which I guess is what happens to neighbours from hell eventually, all of them.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens to neighbours from hell. Now, while we don't yet know what the final outcome will be for the latest round of Brexit negotiations, the Brits are determined to stick to a radical right-wing agenda which will allow access to the single market while still making it possible for the radical right conservatives in Boris Johnson's cabinet to degrade worker protections, erode social protections, and do little or nothing to protect the environment. And that's their project. But the Europeans, on the other hand, have been totally resolute in protecting the integrity of the single market and resisting Johnson's race to the bottom. And as everyone knows, Johnson was politically aligned with the Trump project and was hoping that a quick and dirty trade deal with the US might provide political support for the kind of Singapore on the Thames economic model that he and his cabinet have in mind. Deregulated, low tax, you know, a very right-wing agenda. But it seems unlikely that Biden will play along with this project, which leaves Johnson facing the European Union negotiators who, despite all his attempts at dividing and rule, apparently remain totally united. And that's not what he expected. So here we are, days away from the end of the Brexit transition. Trucks have already started to back up over many, many kilometres on both sides of the EU and the UK border. And the free traders who push the Brexit project might well end up with a no deal, which introduces tariffs where previously there were no tariffs, and which might lead to a whole raft of new customs paperwork when previously goods and services could flow freely between Europe and the European Union countries. The Brexit project was to break the European Union's resolve, to break the whole project of trying to create an international rules-based trading order. In other words, to create a kind of globalization where there were no rules, no frameworks for cooperation. And that project has failed.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Many nations across the world have been hit hard by COVID, and they need to salvage their financial situations fast. And COVID has highlighted even more all the underlying historical reasons for who's on top in our world and who isn't. We know things like wealth taxes and excess profit taxes are part of the solution, but what about our historically undertaxed finance sectors that sit right at the top of the tree? This month, the TaxCast looks at financial transaction taxes.
Well, New York, as you know, is about 20 million people. This year, it got hit very hard by the COVID epidemic.
This is Jim Henry speaking from New York. He's an economist, lawyer, and Tax Justice Network senior advisor.
We had an enormous surge in fatalities, and the hospitals were filled up. And so I think New York is pretty severely impacted. We've had a real surge in unemployment. So states and municipalities are facing big deficits. New York's looking at a $60 billion deficit over the next 2 years, which is a substantial. It's the largest deficit it's ever had. They're looking at laying off thousands of state employees and reducing investments in things like the transit system, basically talking about a 20% reduction in services. So this has increased pressure on state and local governments to look at alternative sources of revenues. And that's where the topic of the financial transactions tax comes in, because New York is the home to two of the world's largest stock exchanges, the NASDAQ, NASDQ, and the New York Stock Exchange. And together they account for roughly 40 to 50% of all the transactions on stock markets in the entire world. This year it's been, on the average, something like $4 to $5 trillion a month of stock trades have gone on these two New York exchanges.
It's well worth asking, isn't it, to whose benefit this high volume of exchanges is. As TaxCasters will know, high levels of financial transactions aren't necessarily a measure of productivity or investment in anything useful.
Yeah. What's happened on Wall Street in the last couple of years is just amazing in terms of the volumes of really speculative transactions. You know, the stock exchange has turned into kind of a casino. It's always been a bit of a casino, but you have something called high-frequency trading. The average trade lasts 10 seconds. and accounts for 70-80% of volumes. And it's just simply firms that specialize in arbitrage that are sort of rushing a whole river of transactions through these exchanges that are purely speculative. And financial transactions are enormous, but if you put a tiny tax, nobody will notice.
No one would notice. But the finance sector hates the very idea of it because they know once that door opens a crack and the fairness of it and the ease of collection is clear, that door will never close again and it could open even wider. And they also know a financial transactions tax isn't only about raising revenue, it's about transparency around transactions, slowing them down and discouraging economically damaging transactions.
And it's interesting that, you know, now the gospel is spreading from Africa to the more developed world that, you know, have been overtaken by the likes of Kenya and Tanzania and South Africa in implementing a Robin Hood tax.
Francis Karugu is an economist and international development specialist in Kenya.
Kenya has been running a deficit budget over the last 7 years, and the government has also been trying to look for ways to raise new revenue. In Kenya, the cabinet minister in charge of treasury actually went to parliament and said, I am proposing to apply a Robin Hood tax on financial transactions in the budget statement that he read in June, July of 2018. The Robin Hood tax in Kenya, which is really a financial transactions tax, has been in effect now for 2.5 years.
It's still early days with Kenya's modest financial transactions tax, or as Francis Karugu prefers to call it, a Robin Hood tax.
It hasn't raised much, but it's definitely a good foundation, especially in a country like Kenya where, you know, the financial services sector is a vibrant one and it is growing, and the fundamentals are there for it to afford the government to even collect more revenue in future. From inception, the tax rate was very low at 0.05%. The biggest catchment here for the government was really the $45 billion worth of transactions that go through our banks every financial year. The $45 billion figure is what was transacted in 2018. 60% is, you know, larger transactions are transacted through banks. And the government put a minimum transaction size of $5,000, that is 500,000 Kenya shillings. A figure of $5,000 is not a figure that most Kenyans, the Kenyan you meet on the street, will transact, you know, a transaction of $5,000. And therefore, it makes sense to call it, you know, a Robin Hood tax, because transactions of $5,000 is either high net worth individuals or corporations that are making purchases or they are making payments. The transaction would also capture payment of salaries. Only less than 5% of Kenyans earn salaries of more than $5,000 a month. And therefore, the application of a 0.05% levy on transactions of $5,000 and above definitely makes it a Robin Hood tax in the Kenyan context.
Despite the small nature of Kenya's new tax, there was still huge opposition from the Kenyan Bankers Association and from stockbrokers. But the tax went ahead.
Applying a 0.05% on 60% of $65 billion, that's the amount of money that was transacted through banks in 2019, that raised a figure of $20 million. It may sound like a little amount of money, but in an economy like Kenya, that's a very significant amount, because that translates to 0.1% of the total tax revenue collected in the country. And in the second year of its application, I think that's very good progress, especially for an economy like Kenya, where, you know, Nairobi is one of the less than 100 international financial centers, and it's positioning itself to be a regional hub for financial services.
And given that positioning, there are additional strong benefits of Kenya's financial transactions tax other than raising revenue.
The good thing is that the financial transactions tax also would be a way of tracking illicit flows, especially monies that come from you know, other jurisdictions, because the financial system in Kenya is very porous. And if you look at the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index, Kenya is number one in Africa. So it means that a lot of inflows come to Kenya from other countries. without any verification of where the source was, or even the real motivation of these funds in this country. And since most of these funds come through in the guise of investments, you know, foreign direct investment, you know, maybe through fundraising, private placements or private equity, they have a way of avoiding paying taxes in Kenya. But, you know, with the Robin Hood tax, it gives the government an opportunity to track these funds as they come into the country. And it's an opportunity for the government, since they come and they are already liable to tax, that the government is able to quantify or even understand the quantum of the flows that are coming into the country and be able to draw a line what are illicit flows and what are genuine investments that are coming into the country. If developing countries are going to implement a Robin Hood tax, really bank transactions would be a good start, especially given the fact that we have a lot of multinational activity here in Kenya, some of which are not even registered here in Kenya, but are registered in our tax havens, but they do make transactions in Kenya. So then the Robin Hood tax would be able to net some bit of revenue, since they are doing business here in Kenya and they are making money here from Kenya.
Back to Jim Henry in New York now, where he's been working with local politicians and other campaigners, teachers and nurses unions to get enough backing for a financial transactions tax bill in New York State.
New York actually first adopted a financial transactions tax of its own in 1905, and that tax is still on the books. It's called the stock transfer tax. It's a tiny tax. It's about 5 cents. It's a nickel per $100 in the U.S. But with the transactions running at $5 trillion a month, that's enough to generate as much as $4 to $5 billion in taxes, depending on the month. You know, on average, probably around $2 billion of tax revenue to New York State.
Thanks to bank lobbying, they stopped that tax dead in its tracks. Since 1981, it's just a 0.03% tax on all stock trades on the Nasdaq New York Stock Exchange. Reintroducing just this modest tax would set a powerful precedent for finance sectors everywhere, which, after all, have been raging relatively unchecked for so long. Campaigners in New York State now think they have enough support to get a vote on it and pass it. And really, New York State should be passing a more ambitious financial transactions tax. But this is just the beginning.
We're talking about a 0.1% tax, a dime per $100 of shares. And that's just not going to affect anyone. And, you know, all of the economists in the world basically agree on this. It's a brilliant, easily collected tax. It doesn't cause any pain to investors. Wall Street, or the billionaires on Wall Street, have seen a $1 trillion increase in their net worth since March because of the impact of the pandemic on the stock value of companies like Amazon. You know, so those folks are not hurting. I mean, there are damn few alternatives. Do you want us to really just fire all the state workers, shutting down schools and laying off teachers and fire people and, you know, how do you get Wall Street to pay its fair share here?
In the European Union, talks are resuming on the long-proposed EU-wide financial transactions tax, a 0.1% tax rate for transactions in all types of financial instruments, except for derivatives, which would be subject to a minimum 0.01% tax rate. Various lobbies had managed to quash the EU-wide attempt, leaving it just to individual member states to implement. But now the European Union's revisiting it as part of their COVID rescue budget they're trying to pass. And there are bigger questions to ask about going further than just tapping financial sectors for a few cents or pennies.
The free movement of international capital needs to be disrupted and dismantled as part of a reparations agenda. Defunding the financial markets through an iterative tax can provide a blueprint for building a post-capitalist world.
Economist Kevil Baradia spent 15 years working in London Stock Exchange. He's talking systems change, and his work demonstrates how transformational a financial transactions tax could be.
So how much money could be raised? The value of global capital flowing through financial markets is actually £28 trillion per day. That £28 trillion per day comes from both exchanges, like the London Stock Exchange, the New York Stock Exchange, the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, but it also comes from the over-the-counter trading done by the world's biggest investment banks, whose wealth can be traced directly back to enslavement and colonialism. Liberal campaigns for a financial transaction tax to date have not critically engaged with the financial market's intrinsic relationship with these issues. The tax could easily raise just by applying a 0.05% tax rate. Don't forget, VAT is charged at 20%. So if we just charge a 0.05% tax rate, we're looking at £14 billion per day to fund reparations and systems change. I've estimated how much that could be in the UK, which is around £500 million per day. That's over £100 billion per annum. And actually, these figures include exchange traded and over-the-counter markets. They also include the major asset classes traded across all financial markets, including equities, bonds, foreign exchange currencies, and commodities markets. And commodities markets are also large. That's where oil and gas is traded. Oil and gas that's plundered, metals that are plundered get traded through the commodities markets. And also with the rise of financialization, most financial markets trading is increasingly on paper without the need for these physical assets, but are still leveraging these physical assets. This number actually doesn't include the world's gold and silver exchange, which is based in London. They do not publish transparent data. So the world is far from poor. The tax over the longer term enables the transformation of global power relations and the dismantling of imperial capitalism that maintains poverty, inequalities, and ecocide.
It seems like the right time, you know, for everybody to get together and to have a kind of race to the top for the financial transactions tax. We could end up, I think, you know, in the not too distant future with quite a good success story here in New York.
We'll see how all that goes. Thanks for listening, and thanks for remaining with us throughout this year of turmoil. We'll be back with you next month. We're going to be kicking off 2021 with practical ways to fix and heal our world. Bye for now.
Hello and welcome to a brand new edition of UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva, a weekly news podcast and review of international events making the headlines at the United Nations. Thanks for listening. I'm Daniel Johnson, and in today's show, a massive insecurity and displacement crisis in northern Mozambique that's galvanizing the humanitarian community. Concern from the UN Human Rights Office over the arrest of demonstrators in Thailand under treason laws, and on International Migrants Day on Friday the 18th of December, a warning that tens of thousands of desperate people continue to risk their lives on dangerous journeys across deserts, jungles and seas, and many die along the way. That's all in the news bulletin coming up shortly. But first, something much brighter. Allow me to introduce irrepressible comedian AK Dance. He was born in the world's largest refugee camp, Kakuma, in Kenya, after his mother fled violence in South Sudan. AK is now a successful stand-up artist, and his latest challenge is taking part in an online show to tackle stereotypes about refugees. There are nearly 26 million globally, by the way, and around half are under 18 years old, according to the UN. So back to AK Dance and his story. In our Zoom interview, I started by asking him, has he always been a funny guy?
Yeah, I think so. I've always been that kid that everyone wants to hang out with in school. And I've always been a stubborn kid in school and all that. Sits in the corner, smart as well, but always like funny and all that. So I think so. But you know, being a funny kid is way different from being a stand-up comedian. These are two different standards.
Okay, tell me why.
Building a joke, coming up with a joke, set up a punchline and standing in front of people, it's not about being a funny person. They're funny people and they are stand-up comedians. That's a different art. You stand high chances of offending someone, and you got a flow because it's a pattern. There's a setup, there's a punchline and all that. So you got to know how to go around all that, and everything you do goes through those lines. And it's just, it's an art. It's an art form. It's not something you learn it.
you're trying to get a reaction from the crowd. I've seen a few of your shows online and they're very funny. You've got this massive smile and you really bring the audience with you. But you're also quite rude to them, aren't you? You say, oh, in Uganda, you make fun of Ugandans and I don't know. How do you get away with it?
I think you made fun of the president even. Yeah, I did once. Because I speak Luganda, I've experienced some of the things that go on. And so when I speak their language, they become less judgmental towards me. They're like, oh, he's in the same boat with us. He can go ahead. And we talk about it. We laugh about it.
Can we start then at the beginning? So you grew up in Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. You're originally from South Sudan. And it wasn't until you got out of the camp that you realized things were different and that there was no need to stereotype people from refugee camps. So tell us how you use comedy to break these stereotypes.
So yeah, I was born in the refugee camp. My mom went to the refugee camp about 1995, something like that. And I was born right there in 1997. To me, it was just the same. You don't know anything else. I've never seen anything else except that. We had our, every Sundays, we had our cultural dances. The camp is divided into groups and zones. So I was from group 15. And all the time we'd go and watch cultural dances in other groups. And we would go to a place called Hong Kong and watch movies and all that. So like it was only when I started stepping out and started seeing, oh, it's a different place. Oh, people use concrete houses. Oh, they're roads. Oh, they're this. You get the point? That I started seeing different things and a different way of living. A lot of refugees that were born there would identify with me right now. To me, it helps me describe activism to me. Because right now, to me, it's all about me telling my story. Because everyone else has told the story of an African refugee child. The story is flies in your mouth. I don't remember any fly in my mouth. So I show up, I'm like, hey guys, I don't really remember having a fly in my mouth. So to me, I use that like to tell my own story. It's my time to tell my story. I'm like, yo guys, I think I had some fun. I think there were some good times. I think I went to school. I think there were some great things out of it that I try to tell as like a testimony, like a real testimony. So that's what I can, and it's all about, even the negative things, it's all about embracing them and find what's funny out of it. Because way from when I was a child, whatever was wrong, we would just find it funny after some time. We just tried to laugh it out and all that.
But obviously there were dark moments and your mother was forced to flee South Sudan and go to Kakuma, the biggest refugee camp in the world. So was your comedy a sort of crutch for her? Was it a way of helping her cope with obviously some very difficult moments?
She always tried to blame herself for the circumstances that I was born in. Unfortunately, she's not alive today to see and for me to see if it comforts her or anything like that. But all I know for sure is that if I accepted what it is, I make the best out of it, she would be less cruel on herself. Like she wouldn't blame herself as much. So to me, it's more of like, hey, mom, this is great. Thank you for raising me in the camp. I'm having fun. I'm enjoying. I'm traveling the world. I'm doing comedy. And they want to listen to all these stories. So to me, it's more of like trying to make her feel like it's okay. You get the point. Unfortunately, she's not alive to see all these things today. But yeah, to me, that's what it is.
I'm very sorry to hear that she's no longer with you. You say that you use activism to be a voice for refugees. And I remember reading that you said rather than just doing shows for non-refugees, you really wanted to talk to refugees.
Yes, it was actually. So I had a mini program that I just did with my friends around me. I used to like ask for some stuff that they have, some stuff they don't want to use, some clothes, some shoes and all that. I wanted to do this small program where I can go to a refugee camp and just do a few minutes of comedy, distribute whatever I have in the schools. And then, so I was collecting a lot of stuff from friends. I actually have a lot of stuff at my brother's house right now that I collected. And I wanted to start delivering them this year, but COVID like kind of stepped everything. And I want to go back and do that still. I want to jump into that same thing and have some fun with them, share whatever I have with them.
You think you will perform for them?
I will perform for them. When the right time comes, when all the COVID thing is sorted out, I will perform for them.
Now, how do you keep this positive outlook? I know you'd say that Kakuma isn't all doom and gloom. I know that as well as comedians who've come out of the camp, there are also Olympic athletes and many other very successful people. It is nonetheless a pretty tough situation to be in. How do you keep positive given that there is ongoing conflict and we're told that conflict and displacement are just getting worse?
You know, the blame game doesn't help, right? The rest of the world is doing what they have to do to put an end to this. There are so many organizations that work day and night to make sure that we stop producing refugees and also help support the ones that are in the camps and all that. What I do is just that, oh, it's still here. Let's fight it. But while we fight it, let's give the ones that are here a livelihood. Let's support each other. Let me guide others on how I made it through, how I survived it. And then the blame game should be whatever comes up in the... I mean, countries are signing peace agreements. My own country just signed a peace agreement and we're embarking on it and all that. Yeah, South Sudan. this is not the right time to play the blame game. You get what I'm saying? So, okay, I do encourage people to stop the wars and all that, but my mind is not so much on trying to point fingers and all that.
Now, I'm talking to you because you're taking part in a show called Comedy with a Purpose with some of the biggest names in African comedy, including Basket Mouth and Eddie Caddy. You know these guys. How exactly is the
yes.
show taking place? Is it virtual?
Yeah, it's a virtual show. So it's a show that's hosted by the Lukuluku tribe. The Lukuluku, it's a campaign that I was invited to be part of. It was started off in 2017 that's supposed to like help change the narrative of an African refugee and all that. You get what I'm saying? And when I was told that, hey, can you jump on and do this? I was really excited because this is what I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to be part of such an amazing ideas that pay back to my community and my people. It's really exciting. It's really exciting. The show is called Africa is a Continent. African is a country. It's a very exciting thing.
What does that mean, Africa is a continent? I understand that bit, but African is a country. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, like, of course, it can be interpreted in very, very many ways. Everyone can interpret it in their own way. And in my own way, one of the reasons why I accepted it is for people to know that when I say African, it doesn't mean like the whole continent. Like, we have so many people in Africa, like so many. We have South Sudanese, Nigerians, Ugandans, Kenyans, and to mention but a few. And I happen to be one of those people. I happen to be South Sudanese, but in general, it's Africa. So when people try to refer to us like, oh, you're from Senegal. You're from Africa. Like, yeah, I am, but I have a place where I'm from. Some people will tell you, are you from South Sudan? Like, yes. And then like, oh, I know someone in Cameroon. Like, it doesn't work like that. To other people, they think Africans are just some cousins or they're just one extended family.
Oh, dear.
It's more about celebrating our diversity. Like, much as we are Africa as a continent, we got so many people, and our diversity is our pride. So many tribes, so many cultures and everything.
Understood. Thank you. Thank you for explaining that to me. So because this show, this UNHCR, UN Refugee Agency, and I'm going to mess it up now, Lukuluku movement, which is about activism to change preconceptions about refugees. Physically, you're used to being quite a presence on stage. You're incredibly tall and you've got this massive smile and you're quite imposing. How do you get that across online? How do you convey that comedic message that you want to?
Well, one of the things that we're really gifted with as human beings is the fact that we can adapt to whatever situation that we jump in. We are like 10 months into COVID-19 right now. If you haven't adapted yet, then you're the problem. So it's more about like, oh, we are in, we jumped in. We're in the deep side of the pool. It won't be a problem. It won't be a problem.
Comedian AK Dance there. And now it's time for the news. In northern Mozambique, attacks by violent extremists have created a mass displacement emergency which has left 1.1 million people in need of assistance and protection. In an appeal for $254 million, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, detailed rising violence, conflict and insecurity in Cabo Delgado and neighbouring provinces this year. Spokesperson Jens Lacke said that attacks and fighting have forced tens of thousands of people from their homes every month. Nearly 530,000 are now internally displaced in Cabo Delgado, Nampula and Niassa, almost five times the number registered in March 2020. Here's Jens Lacke now.
People fleeing violence in Cabo Delgado have been exposed to severe violations and abuses, and we are especially concerned for the plight of children and women. Women and girls are at risk of abduction, gender-based violence and exploitation, while boys are at risk of being killed or recruited by armed groups.
Tens of thousands of desperate migrants continue to embark on dangerous journeys across the world's deserts, jungles and seas, and thousands are dying along the way. That's the stark message from UN Migration Agency, IOM, which said on Friday, International Migrants Day, that it had recorded 3,174 deaths worldwide on the routes that vulnerable people take. Although this number represents a significant drop in deaths compared with previous years, likely linked to more than 90,000 COVID-19 restrictions around the world, some routes saw an increase in fatalities, IOM said. This includes the 593 people who've died en route to Spain's Canary Islands so far in 2020, compared with 210 in 2019 and 45 in 2018.
In Thailand, the arrest of demonstrators under treason laws is deeply troubling. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, said on Friday. The announcement comes after the authorities charged dozens of activists in past weeks, OHCHR said, including a teenage protester. Spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani said that they could face prison sentences of between 3 and 15 years.
We are deeply troubled by the move by Thai authorities to charge at least 35 activists over the past few weeks, including a 16-year-old student activist, under Article 112, which is the lese majesty provision of Thailand's criminal code. The offence carries sentences of between 3 and 15 years imprisonment for defaming, insulting, or threatening the country's royal family. We are particularly alarmed that the 16-year-old activist was presented by police to the juvenile court with a request for a detention order.
Ms. Shamdasani noted that numerous UN human rights mechanisms had repeatedly called on Thailand to bring its treason law in line with the country's international obligations concerning freedom of expression, as stipulated in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. A roundup of this week's headlines there, and before that we heard irrepressibly upbeat South Sudanese comedian AK Dance, who was born and raised in Kakuma refugee camp, and his mission to break stereotypes about refugees and help those living in camps once the coronavirus crisis allows him to move freely again. And of course, we wish him all the very best with his project, and we hope to hear from him again. But now it's time to turn to our guests, Solange Berhotegui-Cortez and Alpha Diallo from the Information Service at UN Geneva. Hi, guys.
Hola.
Well done.
We're speaking remotely as we have to at the moment, but let's get to it. Over the years, Solange, we've reported on migrant caravans in Latin America, thousands and thousands of people of all ages heading through Central America to escape lack of opportunity and desperate poverty. And also this week, Venezuela, where there's an economic crisis and a long-standing political impasse that's created a mass exodus. Now, we had a news alert on that this week, a really sad one, because at least 21 Venezuelans who attempted to reach Trinidad and Tobago, they died when their boat capsized off the coast of Venezuela. The UN Refugee Agency said on Tuesday that this represented one of the biggest single losses of life involving Venezuelan refugees and migrants trying to cross that stretch of sea, which is only at its narrowest point, about 15 kilometers from Venezuela. Any reaction from you, Solange?
Yeah, I couldn't help thinking how 15 kilometers can change your life, how 15 kilometers can take your life. And yesterday, after hearing this sad news about the tragedy, I looked online to see how much a ticket would cost to get from Guiria in Venezuela, where these people set out from in their boat, to Trinidad and Tobago. And the first entry I got was one-way ferry ticket, travel time, 2 hours, 30 minutes, costs 125 euros. 125 euros, the cost of a life, obviously too much to pay for people desperate enough to run away from their country in dangerous boats run by trafficking networks. I'm from Bolivia. In Bolivia, there are 5,700 Venezuelan refugees. Also, according to the UN Refugee Agency, in May 2019, 16,000 were registered by the government of Trinidad and Tobago.
On the 14th of December, Solange, the UN Refugee Agency was 70 years old. Not that it's a good time to celebrate.
Not really. I mean, the High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said that the organization is not in a mood to celebrate. We can understand this. He also said that almost a year ago, the total number of refugees, internally displaced, asylum seekers, and stateless people reached 1% of the world's population. I wonder what percentage we will consider unacceptable. 2%, 5%, or more?
Yes, so that's, 1%, so 70 plus million people. So, Alpha, can I turn to you quickly? Moving to Central and West Africa, the UN Migration Agency issued an alert that it may have to stop life-saving work rescuing migrants who've been left for dead in the desert by people smugglers. And you've also got a very sad story about a talented young footballer from Senegal, nicknamed Dudu, who died at sea after his father paid smugglers to get him to Europe.
Yes, that's right, Dan. Thousands of migrants
fleeing from West and Central Africa are at risk as critical funding from the European Union comes to an end. According to Geneva-based organizations, the end of the program and funding gap raise deep concern about the fate of 10,000 vulnerable men, women, and children. Dan, this call comes amid an increasing number of departures towards the Canary Islands. This maritime route has already claimed the life of over 500 migrants this year. And to conclude, I would like to say a word about this tragic fate of 15-year-old boy Usman Faye, nicknamed Dudu, died at sea in October. His father had paid the equivalent of about $450 to a smuggler. The young man was going to try to get to Italy to train as a soccer player or football player, according to local report. A Senegalese court sentenced the father to a month in prison. The court also gave him a 2-year suspending sentence for risking life.
It's a very, very sad story, and it's unfortunately not that uncommon. Although I should say that often some media will portray a false impression that Western Europe in particular is, quote unquote, under attack from migrants and refugees. This just isn't true, is it?
Sure. When Africa migrates, it's usually to neighboring countries. 4 out of 5 African migrants remain in Africa. And according to African Union, 36 million African migrants are on the African continent. Unfortunately, so far this year, at least 900 people have drowned in the Mediterranean trying to reach European coast. Out of those 36 million migrants in Africa, well over 6 million were refugees by the end of 2018. And according to UN Refugee Agency, refugees originated primarily from the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, and South Sudan.
Thank you, Alpha. So that gives us a better idea of where people are moving to and from, certainly on the African continent. And it's been fascinating hearing your insight from Latin America, Solange, and Alpha from the African continent. So I'd like to thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Dan.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Solange.
Bye.
And thank you, listeners. We'll catch up with you next week. Bye-bye.
That was great stuff. I'm sorry I oops. I made a mistake. You didn't hear my intro about the catch-up special edition to the TaxCast from the United Nations on what's going on there, general news. Catch-up at the United Nations every week. You can get it. If I had more time, I would broadcast it. Thank you for listening. I'll be back on tomorrow with John Grant at This Can't Be Happening, thiscan'tbehappening.net. Thank you for listening.